Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dean Fawcett. I'm the interim director of the Department of Administration and Information. Joining me today to my right is Joyce Heffenheider, who's our deputy director. To my left is Rich Cathcart, who is the General Services Division Administrator. In front of him is Jim Chappett, Construction Management Section Manager. Behind me is Tammy Hooper, Risk Management Section Manager. And directly behind me is Ralph Hayes, Employees Group Insurance Manager. I think we have a team here that could address any of the questions that you have today. Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to go through ANI's budget and discuss with you our 8% reduction plan. ANI is taking the full 8% reduction, which amounts to approximately $3.1 million. Additionally, I will be explaining a little bit later a request where we have two supplemental requests in front of you. One is in our Economic Analysis Division for a software license, and the other is for our Employees Group Insurance Program, which is related to our wellness program. So, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll move forward. For sake of speeding through this process, I will not be covering the MIS gold and silver services that were transferred to ETS, but I did want to point out to the committee today that the Department of Administration and Information did transfer three positions from the department to ETS as a result of ETS consolidation. So those positions have now effectively been transferred over to the agents, ETS, and we're moving forward in that transition. If I could refer you to page 12 of our budget, I'll begin going through each one of the divisions in ANI and the sections within that. Within the director's office, we are proposing or recommending the reduction of $118,000 by eliminating one full-time position. This position is our administrative assistant position for the director's office, providing administrative duties. The position has been vacant since July 1st, and it was vacant due to retirement. Our suggestion is to cut that position and do more of the work ourselves and perhaps use other administrative assistants in other divisions to perform those duties. We believe that this is a reasonable cut, and this is one of two cuts of positions that we're recommending.
Dean, we see throughout these, and I think on page 12, you say for a period of 24 months. Is it really your proposal just to eliminate the position for 24 months, or what does that mean?
It is. The position is vacant and has not been filled. We would be eliminating the position and the support costs associated with that.
If I could, if you look at the governor's message on page 12, and we see this in a couple different places where he says, I recommend the elimination of position in general fund effective July for a period of 24 months. What does that mean? Is that say that we're going to eliminate it, but 2 years you get the position back?
No, Mr. Chairman, that means that the position will be permanently eliminated.
In 24 months, or what does the four period of 20 months mean?
It would be eliminated at the beginning of the biennium for the 24 months.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't understand.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Brett.
Mr. Chairman, essentially what you'll see in these governor's recs is a period of time during the 13-14 biennium in, for which the agency is proposing a reduction or, in this case, the elimination of a position. So sometimes in these recs you'll see a reference to 12 months. Most generally, you'll see a reference to either 12 or 24 months. Sometimes you'll see a deviation from that. I think there was one in the Attorney General's office where there were two eliminated positions. There was a reference to 12 months for one position and 15 months for another position. Essentially, that allows the Budget Division to calculate the dollar savings associated with the elimination of that position and give it some definition and apply that against the 8% reduction that was required in 2014. So an agency may say, this was vacant the 1st of July of 2012, so against the 8% reduction target, we're going to claim all 24 months for the entire biennium. However, once they propose to eliminate a position, that position is eliminated. They may garner credit for it again in the reductions that they're facing for 15-16 because the targets for 14 and then again for 15-16 are based on the same appropriation number.
Well, so here's what you're telling us then is, okay, I have a vacancy and I'm going to eliminate it. Since I'm not going to fill the position, I not only want the elimination of the salary for the fiscal year next year, but I want 6 months credit because it's not filled now. And I want that credit towards the 8%. And it's an interesting issue because now we're back to a semantical game because we said give us 4% of the biennium cuts. And the governor says, well, I'm going to give 8% of the fiscal year. But now you're going to say part of those cuts are going to come out of the existing fiscal year. That's not an 8% of the second fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman, in the context of the biennial appropriation, it allows them to reach that target. What the net effect is for 15-16 is it makes the hill steeper for them to climb in identifying their 15-16 reductions because they don't get to, if they're claiming the full 24 months, obviously that's all they get to claim for the elimination of that position, as opposed to agencies who are saying, we only want to claim the 14 for this time around. They'll be able to take the other half of that in the context of their 15-16 reduction.
Brett, I understand exactly what you're saying, but we said 4% of the biennium, which is what our budget reduction language is. So you would look at your biennial number. Now you're saying 8% of the second year, but you get to carry forward some of your savings in the first fiscal year to the second year. That's not an 8% cut. And you're right. When they come in for the next fiscal, the biennium, that 6 months is not going to help them because you can't biennialize 24 months. You can only biennialize the 12. We'll just remind the governor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we had this discussion early on when we were framing out the basic ground rules associated with the reductions that could be offered up. And this was a fairly significant discussion with agency directors and with the governor's office in terms of how we essentially wanted to manage this issue in the context of the 14 reductions.
Well, here's another thing I would add to it, and that is, if you have a vacancy that you're not going to fill in this fiscal year, on July, those monies revert. Or not after July, so you'd have your annual reversions for dollars. Actually, so is it a biennial or an annual on this 100 series? The biennial reversion? So you're carrying it still in your budget. You're not spending it. So at the end of the day, it's in the budget for reversions if it's not spent.
Actually, with respect to the numbers that we've identified for reduction, this money will go away effective July 1st of 13, because you'll actually pull the dollars from the budget part of the process.
Right. That's where your $60 million comes. You have to physically pull it out to get your 60.
The other consequence, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, is that when you look at that $60 million reduction, you can't double that reduction because of things like this that are included in that $60 million. There's a portion of that $60 million that will biennialize. But when you see a position that's proposed for 24 months, obviously that's not going to happen. And so
So the $60 million is not a $120 million reduction next fiscal year, because some of that was pulled out of vacancies that would have been saved anyway.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and because some of those vacancies are for the full 24 months. Where it's a 12-month number, obviously there's going to be a bump for that $60 million. We at the Budget Division haven't quantified what that is at this point in time, but it's in that $60 million number, obviously.
Have you had these discussions with the governor so he understands?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, I believe he understands that some of these, obviously, that full number will not biennialize.
You have a best guess or an educated guess on about what percentage will biennialize out of the $60
million? At this point in time, Mr. Chairman, I don't. Obviously, it's a number can be calculated. I mean, we can go back through these. We have a spreadsheet that outlines all of the reductions. It would be a fairly simple exercise for us to go through and identify that.
Well, I mean, we probably ought to think about that, because here's Dean saying, look, I've made my 8%. Well, you really haven't made your 8%. You took a vacancy you weren't going to fill. We're going to get credit for you, but next year you're going to have to come up with another position for the next biennium, because the deal is your directors need to know that they're not giving us a full 8%, and they're going to have to further cut for the next biennium.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would look at it differently. They are giving you the full 8% from an existing appropriation. For 15-16, the consequence to them is, instead of having to come up with the other 4% that was identified, you know, essentially the reduction that was identified for 14 doubles in 15-16. Instead of having to come up with another 4%, they may have to come up with another 4.5% or another 5% because of how they've approached the 14 reduction.
All right, let's take a minute then. And when we go back and look at the last budget language for the budgets, is it clear that all agencies have to bring in an 8% reduction in their budgets in next year?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's clear.
And that 8% is calculated off of the standard budget from this biennium?
That's correct.
And not these adjusted numbers?
That's correct. So it's calculated off of the same base number.
All right. Well, then Don and our staff, when we need to go back and review that language and make sure, if we need to clarify that, we're expecting 8% reductions to be brought to us. Your agencies, you need to know that they may have to dig deeper. Like Dean, for example, do you realize that this doesn't get you for the next biennium?
I am aware of that, yes.
And you're really happy about it, too, I can see. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
I think Steve had a question. Don's behind you. Don?
Mr. Chairman, just one quick clarification. It is not 8% of the standard budget. It is 8% of what was approved in the 2012 budget session. Slightly different, but that includes their exception requests that this body approved last year. So it's a slightly larger base that they're taking a cut from.
All right. Does everybody agree? Brett, do you agree with that?
I'm not sure I do, Mr. Chairman. Let me take a look at the language.
Okay, let's take a moment. I mean, it's because if we ought to have an agreement as we move forward what the 8% is from.
Mr. Chairman, if I could read the language here. The language basically says, in preparing the governor's budget request for the 2015-2016 fiscal biennium, reductions totaling 8% of the 2012 budget session general fund appropriation for agency standard budgets, including the Department of Health, shall be included in the governor's recommendation. So from our perspective, that would necessitate us removing any one-time funding allocations But it ties back to the 2012 budget session general fund appropriation associated with agency standard budgets.
Well, but the standard budget would be the budget as it leaves the legislature, not as you built it up in the Chapter 17 process. Agreed?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would agree with that.
I think, is that all you're saying, Don, is that it's the budget that we adopted, so it would be the standard, the Chapter 17 budget as inflated by the legislature and as actually passed out.
Mr. Chairman, that was my point.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and the only differentiation I would make, because it's the same process we utilized in preparing or going through this process, was removing one-time funding, which
is
designated
as such.
Well, for
example, if the highway department had $50 million, they don't have to give a 10% cut out of their operating budget out of their 50. I think we all agree on that. Okay, so then, Brett, I'd like you to make sure, if you would, I'd ask that you be sure to have a discussion with the governor on this issue to make sure that there's no surprises, that he's got credits in here that go beyond 12 months and really don't exact an 8% cut in the second year of the biennium.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, we'll go back and back through the reductions as they exist right now and evaluate those for biennialization so we can basically project the number that we think this will grow by as we move into 15-16.
Well, we're going to need to do that because as we do our forecasts and put them in our spreadsheets to show what these cuts do, I guess when you do your spreadsheet and we're doing our trending, are we trending off of the 10% for the next biennium and 8%, or are we trending the numbers that are provided in this budget?
Mr. Chairman, generally we will trend off of what you approve, which will take away the 8% or $60 million, but then you're, at least under the governor's rec, you're going to add to that. So you're spending all of that, the governor is spending all of that money plus another $70 million.
That's true. Everybody understand the issues? Andrew, what we're just talking about is the, in this budget, when we're looking at it, there's where they had the parenthetical insertion that is for 24 months, they're taking a 24-month credit because the position's currently eliminated against their second year of the biennium. So it's actually that cut will not biennialize that amount because they're getting more credit than they would in a biennial budget. Okay, Dean, go ahead. Thank you for that stop. Sorry. Let's keep moving through it then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes the director's office. On page 25, we list our cuts of about $19,000 total reduction in our surplus property area. We have actualized these cuts because we have had some reduction in some fees charged to us for permanently assigned vehicles, as well as our staff will now be maintaining some of the vehicles themselves. The motor pool has money built in their budget to hire contractual services. It's a small section with three employees. Those contractual services are primarily in the event of a long-term illness or sickness. We believe that we can eliminate those funds to meet our $18,877 reduction in surplus property. Mr. Chairman, moving to...
Let me catch you. What page were you on just now?
25, Mr. Chairman.
Explain it again. So this is the surplus property, and your savings are coming from where again?
Mr. Chairman, the reductions are coming from three areas in particular. One is the reduction of repair and of equipment. We think that we can reduce our budget because we have some newer equipment there. Also, permanently assigned vehicles, the amount that is charged to us from motor pool has declined. That reduction is no longer, those funds are no longer needed in our budget for vehicles. And the third area is in contractual services. This would be in the event that there's a long-term illness of an employee, we could go out and hire somebody to come in and perform those duties for that employee during that absence. The total of all of those adds up to a little over $18,000, Mr. Chairman.
Dean, while we're on that, would you refresh our recollections with respect to the health care, how much for state employees on their, how much time does an employee get to accumulate, and then you have a gifting, you can gift those out, and we've got a new member that's probably a good idea just to explain that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand your question. Accumulate.
You're sick and leave. How many hours can you?
Mr. Chairman, when a state employee begins employment with the state, they begin to accumulate 8 hours. A full-time employee accumulates 8 hours of sick leave per month, as well as 8 hours of annual leave per month.
Okay, and how long does that accumulate?
That, Mr. Chairman, accumulates, and then after 5 years, it bumps up to the 8 hours of sick leave remains the same, but the annual leave bumps up to 12 hours per month. So every 5 years, it increases.
So again, at 10 years?
Yes. Another 2 hours of annual leave.
Okay.
The and maximum of annual leave that any employee can accumulate in 1 month is 16 hours.
Now, is when you talk about are all is both this is for vacation time as well as sick leave, or are there two different categories?
Mr. Chairman, it is two separate categories. 8 hours of sick leave per month remains consistent throughout a state employee's career. That never changes.
And are these, so you get essentially 8 hours of vacation time and 8 hours of sick leave for every month of service?
When you begin work with the state, that is correct.
And then your vacation goes up 12 hours after 5 years.
It increases by another 2 hours per month based on increments of continuous service with the state.
Okay, and then on with both of those, it's not a use it or lose it, rather you can continue to accrue those benefits?
The sick leave is available to the employee throughout their career. But annual leave, they accumulate their leave, but they can only carry over 480 hours per year.
On sick leave.
And so when an employee retires, assuming you have years of sick leave accumulated, you're compensated for that?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. They are paid out for all of the annual leave that they have accumulated, plus up to 480 hours of sick leave, and that's paid at one-half the rate.
And which, both of them are just the sick leave?
Just the sick leave.
And then what is
Mr. Chairman, could you just repeat that? We're kind of typing and talking, so
okay.
Just repeat that, what can be at retirement or termination?
At the end of the year, an employee can only carry over 480 hours of annual leave. So if they...
Mr. Chairman, annual leave as in both sick and vacation or?
No.
There are two separate categories, Mr. Chairman. There is annual leave and there's also sick leave.
Okay, so annual leave is vacation.
Annual leave is paid 100% dollar for dollar.
Annual leave is paid 100% dollar for dollar upon retirement or resignation.
And sick leave is?
Paid out also, but only up to 480 hours total that they can be paid out, and they are paid out at one-half that rate.
So up to 480, and you only get half?
Correct.
And my recollection is for a typical employee that's making $70,000 or $80,000, spend a lifetime, it's about a $40,000 payout typically. Is that a rule of thumb what you're seeing?
Mr. Chairman, that would vary depending on the salary of the employee. They are paid out at the rate of pay at the time of their resignation or termination.
When you see a typical employee retiring, what are the ranges that you're seeing agencies having to pay out for those retirements?
Mr. Chairman, it would not be uncommon for a retiree who has worked for the state for many years to receive the full benefit of the maximum of their annual leave accumulated. The rate of pay for somebody who retires again would vary depending on the level of position they are in.
So are you saying that whatever that employee's salary at that time, it'd be equivalent to an annual year salary?
They would be paid out based on hours. So if the maximum annual leave is 480 hours of annual leave, for example, they would be paid out at their current rate times the 480 hours for annual leave.
Not 40 hours.
We typically see, my last recollection is when we see a typical DEQ engineer retire, that we're seeing a payout of about $40,000 to $50,000. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that would be common for a professional level employee in state government.
Do you see more than that much, that range? I mean, are you seeing people that, what's the highest you've seen?
Mr. Chairman, again, it would vary depending on the level of employee. It could be as high as $60,000, for example, as a payout. The issue with leave payout is it's an unfunded liability, which means that oftentimes an agency would have to leave the position vacant for a period of time in order to recoup those funds to pay out the employee when the employee leaves state government. So there is not a pool in state government to draw upon, and so oftentimes where we see when a long-term employee quits or resigns from the state, an agency is compelled to leave the position vacant for a longer period of time because they have to pay for that payout.
Now, for the new members, they're going to see you do have a pool for the smaller agencies who can't absorb a vacant position.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I understand that certainly agencies have some ability within their agency to transfer funds around, and in a smaller agency, they have the ability to work with the budget division and the auditor's office to recoup those funds that may not be available to the agency.
And the members will probably remember that the Supreme Court is one of those that creates a fund for all the courts because they can't afford to lose an administrative aide, so they have a fund to pay for that. We had talked one time, Dean, about the cost to accrue for that liability, and it says to create a fund, and my recollection is that we're talking $40 to $60 million if we wanted to, or is it even more than that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I believe that the number you present is could be accurate. We do from time to time run those statistics, but I don't have that information today in front of me.
Now, there's also is there a practice to allow employees to gift their sick leave to other employees?
That practice is permitted only in the case where an employee has exhausted all of their sick leave. A agency director can request donated sick leave within the agency for those employees, and after they have requested donated sick leave within the agency, they can go out and request donated sick leave of all state employees.
If an employee has hit that 480 mark, he can gift the overage over the 480 as well. You cap out at 480 hours, but you could then start gifting your hours out.
There is a limit on how much any employee can donate leave to another employee. That limit is 2 days or 16 hours.
Each employee can only give 2 days.
Each employee can only donate a maximum of 2 days of leave to another employee.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Circling back to the original thing on your budget, where you're talking about a amount of money that was in your agency to pay for the possibility of someone taking an extended leave, and then you having to hire contractors. Does every agency, maybe this is a question for Brett, is that a common thing throughout state agency that there's a chunk of money that is sitting there in case people are on extended sick leave and you need to hire contractors to fill the position?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, I am not aware of funding available for that purpose in agency budget. And I'm not that was not my understanding of the testimony, but I misheard what was said. But no, I don't believe there's funding available to hire contractors to backfill positions where someone might be on extended sick leave. Now, often there may be vacancy savings, but that wouldn't be used to hire contractors because it's tied up in the 100 series.
I think what you first talked about, a reduction in your account for contract hires, and it sounded like it was for a backfill for agencies that have lost staff or have 60. Maybe you might explain what you remember the statement you made, and maybe explain that.
Mr. Chairman, because the surplus property section is so small with only three employees, and the amount of supplies that they are managing, oftentimes if an employee was injured or out on sick leave, they would have to hire someone else to come in and provide those services. What we are suggesting is that that money is not needed in the surplus property section budget to cover any contractual services. So we are suggesting that approximately $3,000 could be eliminated for that purpose. That is part of the amount that rolls up $3,000 into the total of the $18,800.
So I understand this is for a very small agency, but how does a larger agency deal with it when they may have one or more? I assume that, you know, these things happen. People have to take extended sick leave, and agencies need to continue to meet their mission. How do they handle that?
Mr. Chairman, if that situation arose in an agency such as ANI, we would certainly look to funding available in other divisions, first of all. We would also look at the possibility of repurposing positions to cover those duties while somebody is out on leave, for example.
Mr. Chairman, just in follow-up, I believe there are some larger agencies that may have funding typically in their 900 series to utilize for temp services. And they use those temp services for a variety of purposes. I don't think you typically see that, especially in the smaller agencies, that kind of funding available. But in some of the larger agencies, when you look at your 900 series report, you're probably going to see some of those temporary employment agencies as listed vendors in some of those reports.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to page 29, which deals with risk management, I'd like to point out to the committee that this reduction of $1.5 million represents approximately half of the total reduction that the Department of A&I is recommending before you. The $1.5 million is a reduction, and as you know, the risk management program, we have a self-insurance fund that primarily covers other state agencies. It covers all police officers in the state as well as covering the courts and judges. With our self-insurance program, we also cover auto insurance for the state, and it is a very large program. The fund receives revenue primarily from five primary resources. The first is that we receive funding from the general fund. Currently, we receive about $10.2 million appropriated each biennium for risk management purposes. We also have funds that at the end of the fiscal year, if all of those funds are not expended as a result of the $10.2 million that's appropriated, those are retained within the program. Since we do accumulate lots of funds, we also have the ability to generate interest on those funds. The interest is generated. The money is deposited at the beginning of the biennium. And currently, we are generating approximately $2 to $3 million per biennium just on interest alone. The state also oftentimes goes out and purchases insurance from private vendors. And if there is a loss and there is a claim that is paid back to the state, that money would then be deposited back into this account. And the last or the fifth area that we generate funds for our risk management program relates to charges that we may actually charge the agency for a particular loss. Last year, that was approximately $2.8 million. As you can imagine, since we're self-funded, oftentimes we do have risks, and you will recall that it was 2 years ago, the city of Cheyenne experienced two major hailstorms. As a result of that, the risk management program was forced to pay out a significant amount of money for auto insurance and repairs to state buildings as well as the Capitol Dome. Also, in recent years, we had flooding around the state, so any damage to state property was paid as a result of claims submitted to the risk management program. We actually presented to this committee reducing this fund last year and did receive some pushback from the committee. We did, as a result of that pushback, go back and have an independent consultant come in and review the soundness of our risk management program. We hired a consultant that came in and that was completed this summer, and the actuarial actually concluded that our current risk management program is very sound and very well funded. The balance of the risk management program today is approximately $48 million that we have available to us. I would point out that we have had ups and downs in that balances, but that is a very substantial amount of money, and we believe that the reduction of $1.5 million will not significantly impact the risk management program. The fund does require that we keep 3 years of reserves for possible claims coming back to the state. In the worst case scenario, those claims would be approximately $29 million. But because of this large reserve, we believe that we can reduce our budget by $1.5 million. And ideally, the general fund standard budget would not be reduced, and the funds would continue to grow at their current rate as they have over the past 10 years. The risk with this is obviously if there were another major catastrophic loss to the state, it would have an impact on the fund. But at this point, we believe that our fund is very sound, and the reduction of $1.5 million is reasonable.
Okay, and so for the new members, I mean, this is the fund where you begin to see the impact of your Tort Claims Act, the things where we pay out liability. And it's true that the agency offered these up as cuts in the past, and the difficulty I have is that when you start saying, okay, we're going to cut our budgets by lowering the reserves that we accumulate for catastrophic events, it doesn't take very long to think of a catastrophic event that whether it's a dam or something that we maintain, all of a sudden you've got lots of claims there. There's no way to know. I mean, we've asked Tammy is the manager, and we've asked, say, look, what's the maximum, what's the worst thing can happen? But if you go back 10 or 15 years ago, we were being called upon to make substantial contributions to this account because it was underfunded. And, Dean, you've been around long enough. I think you probably remember those instances. Can you give us an example where the first dollars out of the budget we had to make up this deficit because there was an underage in it? That may have been some of those prison lawsuits.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not recalling a specific example. Maybe
Hooper does.
May go back before Tammy's time. I don't.
Mr. Chairman, that was before my time. I've been here about a year and a half.
Thank you. I've been here about a year and a half. Traditionally, I know that last year there was proposed legislation to increase the limits on the Governmental Claims Act, and that was defeated. Certainly, some of our federal claims with issues with the prisons, those go to the federal side where there's no governmental claims limit. To date, we've not had a large claim that's exceeded the governmental claims limit for Wyoming of $250,000. I work closely with the Attorney General's office. A lot of those claims, we have to address them. We don't consider them frivolous. We do address each and every one of them. But we usually win on a motion to dismiss or a summary judgment. But we do aggressively pursue all avenues of defense for the state, as well as any revenue is probably not the most appropriate term to use when we recoup money. We do have property insurance. We also have an excess policy that does deal with if we have a federal lawsuit, that it has a $5 million limit on it. So we do have outside insurance to help protect the state in instances like that.
Well, I guess going back, I mean, if Dean says we did a study and we're okay and we don't have to accrue at the rate of 10.2, which is what we've been putting in, you know, how many years can you reduce that? And, I mean, we've been putting about that much for at least for the last 10 years, haven't we?
That's true, and certainly at the end of the last biennium on June 30th, we did have a surplus of about $500,000, and that stays in there. It's not the spend it or lose it, so that stayed in the fund. So we in the last 2 years, that was certainly an abnormal year. We had catastrophic losses with the hailstorm, two of them, within a two-week period. The majority of that is covered under property insurance because of the damage to the roofs. However, we did have to, we self-insure our autos and our auto glass, and so we paid out money for those claims because the state self-insures their auto. So to date, we've paid out about $225,000 in hail damage to state agencies' autos.
Okay, well, folks, I think it's you're going to be doing the markup, but it's dangerous to say we're going to do our cuts by cutting out our insurance and the rate of accumulation and saying, well, we just save money, but you're going to pay later because you haven't built your reserve high enough. Drew?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this might be a question for you, but in that, I mean, when you look at this, it's a reserve fund. So when we cut it here, I don't know that it's really a cut because it's a reserve. But beyond that point, it says right now there's about a $40 million. We've accumulated about $40 million in this. We don't reappropriate that every year, do we?
That's a carryover balance. It's appropriated in. Okay. You could appropriate out of it if you wanted, but
right.
It carries over from year to year. And I want to say that before we started into Tammy, what you might do is give us a fund history like the last 15 years. I think you probably have that, don't you?
I can certainly ask Rory Horsley, who's what? Our accounting manager. I think she's prepared that in the past, so that won't be an issue.
Why don't you do that?
Because to you, Mr. Chairman.
And I have a strong recollection that most of this surplus has been built up since we had the natural gas bump in the 2000s. So when you go back to the 90s, we had no money. We had a low fund, and we were appropriating into it to make up deficits.
Right.
So we increased this amount to, the $10 million for the biennium when we started having a lot of money. And we're doing a lot of things. There's a lot of exposures out there. You don't have to be very creative to think of events that could tag that count pretty heavily.
Now, The other issue that I think you have, particularly when you do this to reserve funds, is if you have to remember that the way that the governor's budget presentation was that he not only in the amount that he looked that was available for general fund appropriation, he took the surplus funds that we've received over and above what was projected, but then he also added in these cost savings to get as a part of the total amount that would be available along with capital gains and other things. But so when you take the money out of a fund, if I'm thinking about this right, when you take money out of a reserve fund and then all you're doing is essentially raiding this fund to spend on general fund appropriation for another purpose.
Exactly. I mean, we're doing nothing in the budget to reduce the risk of loss to the state. We're neither eliminating positions or creating the – if you wanted to lower your budget, you'd have to go change the Governmental Tort Claims Act and lower to $200,000, that would change your budget. But there's nothing the federal law for liability of the state for violations of civil rights, that stays the same. The issue with respect to liability we have when we're engaged in dangerous activities, whether it be snow plows, those things, we do cover some of those losses through insurance and through what happens on the snow plow. You're looking at me like I may have gone the wrong direction. A snow plow hits a family, what happens?
Oh, if a snow plow hits a family, certainly that's a liability. But we have a number of claims every year. In the summer, it's mowing activities by YDOT. In the winter and spring, it's snow plowing. And, of course, so we'll have a number of claims throughout the year where people have said that their windshields are broke or something like that, and we defend those because they're within the scope of their job duties, and it's not negligence on the part of the state. Now, certainly, and a snowplow is no different than we have employees. We have several auto accidents right now that we're working on settling. We've had employees who've been involved in head-on collisions. They've been driving state vehicles, and certainly the way the Governmental Claims Act reads, with definitions of who's a public employee, that includes volunteers, members of boards, so when they get behind a wheel and they're on business for the state, we indemnify them because that's what the statute says. So we certainly do look to try to settle those, but we are liable for the actions of our employees and our volunteers and our members of boards and commissions.
Yeah. I think your point is we haven't done anything to reduce the risk. We're just saying we're going to save at a lower rate, and that's a savings, and it's not. The risk remains the same. Eli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have the reinsurance at $5 million. Is that correct? Any catastrophic things we've gone outside into the marketplace be able to cover those kinds of things?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, with respect to the losses, if you're talking about a property loss, we have a couple of deductibles. We have a general $100,000 deductible, if you will, for, say, for instance, a fire that occurs. We would pay out the first $100,000, and then the insurance would kick in. We do, because of the storm 2 years ago in July of this coming year, have now a $500,000 ISO CAT policy with catastrophic losses. So if we have another hailstorm, we will have to pay out the first $500,000 before the insurance kicks in. But we are self-insured. We have insurance, property insurance for up to a billion. We have total assets for the state right now carrying on our property schedule of approximately $1.9 billion.
I'm not done yet. Mr. Chairman, then let me ask you this. Like in Fremont County where we had the voting rights issue, and that litigation, was that covered by the governmental claims, and has that come out of your fund to reimburse that situation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, no, that did not come out of my fund. I cover a myriad of issues. We will pay for employment actions with agencies when employees have filed employment actions, but we cover general liability property, the police professional, the judicial districts, and those officers as well, and the Department of Corrections is another one of our customers.
So then, Mr. Chairman, like the situation in Fremont County where the drive-by shooting of our courthouse up there, if someone had been injured, it would have gone into the governmental claims and had the $250,000. That would have been something we would be involved in because of the district court, right, or a circuit court, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, the way that the claim would have had to have developed where there was a cause of action that the state was responsible in order to file a governmental claim.
Well, the argument would be that the building was not safe, and so the state had liability.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, certainly if there was a claim brought against us for that reason that we had, fostered an unsafe environment, then yes, we would be, they would file a claim and we would defend the state.
Mr. Chairman, the last question is, this all goes into the pool accounts, right, managed by the state treasurer, and then they allocate back to you the million, the interest income off of that in the pooled investments. Is that how that works?
I would, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, I would defer to the accountant.
I saw her nodding, so I think that's a yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll do Steve and then back to
When's the last time that we've had to dip into the reserve account, or have we in the last 10 years or so?
At all time.
I mean, I'm looking at the balance grow, though, to $40 million over the last 10 years. That kind of reads your narrative. So you're dipping into it all the time.
You pull in and you put in, you pull out all the time.
Maybe rephrase that. When's the last time we then kind of, have we rolled over money then every biennium for the last 10 years?
I think that, Steve, my recollection is that when Schiffer and I started in, there was a near deficit, and we started this. About that time, we started a much higher contribution level. So if you go back to the 90s, there were times where we had to appropriate into it to meet the claims.
Just to meet the claims. But
that's my recollection. The history will tell you whether it's different.
Well, that's what my question relates to, the history of this.
Maybe I'm the only,
I'm looking at the 10.2, and you're going to have 700,000, it looks like, revert, come back to the fund. So I'm just wondering, if, I don't know.
Right.
So you dip into it all the time. I guess I'm just wondering, the last time we've reduced the reserve. It looks like we've grown the reserve every year. Is that right or not?
The answer is yeah, and that was the intent.
We're
doing more things than we used to. We have more trucks, we have more buildings, we have more employees, we have greater liabilities.
How I mean, your study says, what is the appropriate amount? The appropriate amount is what? Did your study tell you that, or?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Harshman, no. The study gave us a level of the appropriate amount of funding, and for approximately 3 years, if in the perfect storm, every claim was paid out at the maximum, and you had every incurred but not reported claim developed into a claim, then you would possibly look at $29 million in a payout.
That's okay.
And so we have 48. That has grown, of course, since the report earlier this summer. And we did only have a, I know in that report, I believe it said 700,000. We, at the end of June 30th, returned 500, just over 500,000 as what was left in our budget from the last 2 years.
Okay.
Now that's not out of the reserve account. That's out of your operating dollars.
Yeah.
Yes.
Brett's got something that I think Drew is next. Go ahead.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I would just point out in the narrative on page 29, there is a reference to the reserve balance having been $15 million on June 30th, 2003. So that would give you some sense of how the fund has grown since in the last approximately 10 years from that balance of $15 million to, I think the indication from Mr. Fawcett was $48 million at this point in the biennium. So the assumption is that not only are you continuing to contribute the $10 million, but the amount of interest that the fund, the reserve itself is generating, has likely grown in that period of time as well in a fairly significant fashion.
Well, but what I don't think we've ever done is, I mean, if you're sitting there in your Mountain West Farm Bureau and you go out and you assess all of your claims, and they go out and do a risk analysis to figure out what the worst-case scenario is and for how long, and saying what is an appropriate amount of reserves to develop for your risk for the long term, no different than our retirement account. You can go back and say, okay, where are you? Have we ever done anything like that to say, okay, where do we need to be, what rate of savings, and how big does this need to get?
Senator, Chairman Nicholas, we did do the actuary study. It was finished this spring, and their recommendation, when you crunch all the numbers, for 3 years of claims, is approximately $29 million that we need to have in reserves. They don't do projections out. I mean, they'll look at your claims history from the past 5 years. They went back from the inception of the program. And they'll tell you that right now $29 million is approximately what you need to have for the perfect storm for all the claims that we currently have, and certainly with the $48 million in there, I think that anything that we have coming down the pipe with respect to any claims that have occurred that we don't even know about. And there's always things that we are aware of, but they might not develop into a claim, and there's things that happen that we were never on our radar that do develop into a claim. And I think between I hate to call it a buffer, but between what we have there with our and in addition to our operating budget, I feel comfortable with what we have based off of what the actuary had also said.
When the actuary looks at it, are they looking at that just 1 year blip? What happens if you have two or three of those in a row?
Senator Nicholas, well, they do look at the overall years, and I'm not sure if they do a smoothing on that or not, but they do. We do give them some insight into certain things that might have happened. They'll ask us if there are any outstanding types of issues, what had happened. So we did go through the catastrophic hail damage that we had 2 years ago, and if we have any known pending lawsuits, any federal lawsuits or anything like that, we will tell them. And we've also told them of any possible cuts or any kinds of budget changes.
And you say we've insured ourselves above $5 million. So if you have the wrongful detention person that gets a $40 million verdict because he was incarcerated for 40 years wrongfully, and you see these periodically around the country, and you see magnificent verdicts in those. What happens then?
Senator Nicholas, well, We are insured for up to $5 million. We have an excess policy. It has $1 million deductible, and then it has a $5 million payout. So anything above that, then, of course, the state would be liable for.
So you have one claim that I think Spence Law Firm is trying one this week in the Midwest where a gentleman was incarcerated for a lifetime, and I think they believe they're going to get a $100 million verdict. How do they analyze that?
Sir, I'm sorry, I don't have that answer.
There is a perfect storm out there. Amy, did you have a question? Any other questions? Go ahead.
I apologize because I was late doing attending some. Every once in a while, you have to do stuff for your three-year-old job, you know. But on the reinsurance, a couple questions. If you could just help me understand what it is we reinsure. And then also, when we talk about our deductibles, are they per occurrence or are they aggregate?
Chairman Nicholas and Senator Perkins, excuse me. Okay. We insure property, and we insure, we have the excess policy. We also insure the aircraft for YDOT and the equipment that's in the aircraft. So with respect to the deductibles, again, with property, a fire, pipes break, that's $100,000. If we have a catastrophic occurrence now, because we have a claims history of claims filed for weather, we have a $500,000 deductible. Most of the claims that we deal with seldom reach the $100,000 unless it's some type of a catastrophic loss. So internally, our agency takes care of almost all of the claims. We take care of all of the claims, but we pay out for all of the claims. And with respect to the excess, that's in the event that we had perhaps a federal tort. And so we pay out the first $1 million, and then the insurance would kick in for the up to the $5 million.
Mr. Chairman, the so let's go back and to make sure I understand. You referred to a couple summers ago. You had two hailstorms in the same summer.
Yes, sir.
Right. And so would that be under what it is now? Would that be $500,000 for each storm, or $500,000 for the combination of both storms?
Chairman Nicholas, Senator Perkins, those were separate occurrences. And so we do have per occurrence coverage, and I apologize for not answering that to begin with. So we had a storm that occurred on July the 12th. That was one occurrence. Then we had another hailstorm that moved in on July 21st, I believe it was. That was another occurrence. Those are considered property claims. And so at the time, 2 years ago, the deductible was $100,000. It would have been for each storm. $500,000 per each storm, because we have a claims history. Currently, we are looking at a payout from the insurance company of probably upwards of about $3 million back to us.
You hit your deductible, but I assume there's no cap on the $5 million on that. Your cap is your insured asset, which is $1.8 billion or whatever it is.
Chairman Nicholas, yes, that's correct. The $5 million cap is only on the excess liability. So what you'd have to do would be to exhaust your first coverage under your general liability policy prior to the excess kicking in. So with the property coverage, they would cover the catastrophic loss.
So like the Capitol building, we have a value, and it's probably insured up to its value, and they don't replace the Capitol, I assume.
Well, depending on if there was a fire, we would pay the deductible, and then they would, you know, if there was a total loss, then yes, we would ask for the insured value of the building.
The insured value as opposed to replacing it.
Well, no, actually replacement.
Okay. Replacement value. Okay, good. Other questions? Support and count. Go ahead.
I don't know whether it's for Dean or for Brett, but the question I would have, and in the world I live in the business world, you know, when times are difficult and you have to look at reductions, you know, there's certain things you do and there's certain things you don't do. And obviously, you can take a reduction in insurance and take that risk. It's a risk that I'm adverse to doing. It's you know, you risk losing everything. And, of course, that would not happen to the state. So I guess my question would be, when you looked at these reductions that you were asked to come forward with, and I think a lot of people thought that what we were really trying to accomplish was a reduction in government, in the size of government, not necessarily reducing our ability to have money in a risk pool. What other areas did you look at, or did you look at other areas in terms of true reduction in government, which is, I think, what we're trying to accomplish and seeing it? And if you can't do it, you can't do it. But I'm curious as to how you went through that process.
Mr. Chairman, ANI is primarily responsible for providing services to other state agencies. So a lot of these categories that we're going over affect those services and abilities that we provide to different state agencies. We asked each division to look at where they thought they could meet their 8% reductions. I'm fairly new to this position, so the budget was actually built under a former director who also reviewed all of this stuff. We did look at positions in our agency, and you'll see that we are recommending cutting positions in our agency. We're also recommending that we cut some kinds of services that we provide. But those are the primary areas that we looked at. The risk management area was a large area that we believed was very funded, very robustly, and we felt that we could include that in part of our 8% reductions.
Good.
And I appreciate that. And I looked in there, and I think you've got 248 employees, and two are going to IT, and then you have a reduction of two. I know one of those is a vacant position, and maybe the other one isn't. But what I don't like to do is, if we said, well, we don't want to cut the $1.5 million from the risk management, and then we go in there and try to do something arbitrarily, I don't think that's a way to run anything. If we had to ask you to say, okay, we're not going to do the $1.5 million there, where would you do that? And I guess you might be thinking about that, and we could have some conversations later about it. And if we really can't do it, and I think that's the conversation we need to have.
I appreciate that guidance, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, just additionally, I think in general terms what we're seeing with departments offering up reductions is an eye cast towards the 8% that's also going to be required in 15-16. And so if there's this is an approach, and I don't want to put words in Dean's mouth, but typically you'll see an approach to the 2014 reductions. You can argue whether some of it's low-hanging fruit or not, but there's a notion that in 15-16 this is going to cut a lot deeper. And I think you're going to see, I suspect, a lot of additional positions offered up in the context of 15-16 that because of that deeper bite. I just think that's inevitable, that people are going to be forced to have to really evaluate further reduction of positions. We've seen 86 offered up in the context of the 14 reductions, and I would suspect that number will get significantly larger. And I know when the governor looked at these reductions, he was very concerned about whether or not we would end up riffing people, reduction in force, or whether or not we would be able to take advantage of existing vacancies in agencies. And I suspect that challenge will become significantly more difficult as we move into looking at 15-16 reductions.
Brett, I appreciate that, but the way to really do it is, to me, it's a lot better to ease into it than have all of a sudden you have to do something that's really catastrophic, if you would. I think you're better off to ease into it. And riffing is something that I don't think that I would want to be a part of, but I think you've got to be planning on that. And if you can do things now, it's always better to ease the pain, to ease into it, rather than all of a sudden, here we go, and then you become some, you take cuts and do things that may be things that you really can't absorb within the department. So I'd rather see us ease into it, make some cuts now, make some hard decisions now, at least start down that path. It's always easy to go the other way. What's harder is when you have to make more. That's just an experience I've had, and I think it's the right way to go. So I guess I would disagree a little bit with you, and I think we should be trying to do more things now, preparing for it, rather than just wait till it happens.
Other questions? Next item, Dean.
Mr. Chairman, I would add to Senator Bebout's comment that within the Department of A&I, we are looking at vacant positions as they become vacant and making a decision about whether we need to refill those positions or we could consider them for a long-term cut. So every time a position vacancy comes open in A&I, internally there's a review process where we look at the need and the validity of filling that position with the concern that there may be deeper cuts down the road. That's a difficult call because obviously every division needs their positions to perform their services, but that is one proactive thing that we're doing within the Department of A&I. The risk becomes is then the longer those positions become vacant, then there comes the question about whether those positions are actually needed. So we are trying to monitor that the best we can with A&I, but we realize that there's a lot more work that will have to be done for further cuts.
Going back before we leave, with respect to the risk management and the what's appropriate level of pool, Tammy, could you get that report to us, your last? Is that anything confidential about that report?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman.
Your actuarial study?
Absolutely not. In fact, the external auditors have a copy now. I can provide it to you.
Yeah, if you'd provide that to the committee and to the staff, we'll get it out. Now, I've always had an uneasiness about this account. When you go back to 2003, that's after it was the 1990s where we were funding it. We had no money, and we've doubled the size of our government. If you look at, we've gone from $1 billion to $3 billion. We have more activities. We have more things going on, and that. It's not, $40 million sounds like a lot of money, but go look at what Farm Bureau or those other, what their reserves look like and what they're doing to cover their risks. So you're going to have to decide. But we set on a task to increase that reserve substantially because some of us simply aren't as risk risk tolerance is much lower than the actuaries. And then to say, well, we're going to stop saving now because we can't afford it, it'd be one thing if we were really, frankly, couldn't afford to do this. But what you're really talking about, I think somebody else pointed out, is saying, well, we'll take $1.5 million out of our developing our risk pool and we'll spend it. We'll buy a building with it, which increases your risk, by the way, because now you have more assets on your list. Okay, next item.
Mr. Chairman, the next item can be found on page 33, and this relates to our central mail section. We are proposing the elimination of one position in our central mail section. This position would be eliminated July 1st of 2013. This position is currently filled. We would certainly do everything we can to move the employee in that position to another one of those positions that we may have vacant in our agency prior so that there is no reduction in force. But this does net in a reduction of one full-time position from our central mail. The outcome of this reduction is that it will have an impact on our delivery services to state agencies. Currently, we provide two drop-offs and pickups a day. We are suggesting that as a result of this reduction that we would move to one drop-off and pickup per day. That would be a little bit of a change from what agencies have become accustomed to in past years, but we have also seen a decline in mail delivery to our state agencies, as a result of email and other electronic information. For those agencies that have critical mail deliveries, we would certainly offer the opportunity for them to come to a central place and pick up or drop off deliveries as necessary. But again, this would help us with our 8% reduction in the agency budget, but it would also have an impact on our other state agencies. We believe that this is acceptable, and we believe that most agencies could live with this reduction or cut.
Other questions? Next item.
Mr. Chairman, the next item is on page 41 of our budget, which relates to our facility operations. We're proposing the reduction of $35,000. The reduction comes primarily from two areas in our budget, primarily for reducing soft goods and supplies within state government and state facilities. Additionally, a year or so ago, the legislature appropriated additional money to purchase equipment. So we have newer equipment in our unit that we believe would not any longer need more maintenance and upkeep. So we're proposing that perhaps $10,000 could be cut for maintenance purposes. That still gives us plenty of money for maintenance and supplies, but we may have to scale back somewhat on the quality of the supplies that we provide to state agencies.
Next item.
Mr. Chairman, the next item can be found on page 49, which relates to utilities. We are proposing the reduction in our utilities budget of about $500,000. The total biennium budget for utilities is $7.5 million. We believe that fund could be reduced. We have never spent the $7.5 million for utilities in past years. Also, we've experienced some milder winters and some decreases in utilities costs. We have been a little proactive with this. We've contacted the utilities and asked them specifically if they saw any rate increases coming in the future, and they indicated that they did not see that. So it's for those reasons the $500,000 is approximately 6.7% reduction in our utilities. There would be obviously a risk with this cut if for some reason we were to experience once again adverse weather conditions or have a spike in utility increases. It would have an impact on us paying those utilities. But we feel comfortable with the reduction of $500,000 in the utility budget item here on page 49.
Question? Don?
Mr. Chairman, just a point of quick information, referring back to the discussion that initiated this meeting relative to the one position that would have difficulty in being biennialized. The last two major items that you've discussed total $2 million, the risk management and the utilities. The same issue here, this would require a $4 million reduction in the 15-16 biennium, which may present difficulties in biennialization.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, the problem with ANI is if you're the resource for people's heat, I suppose you can say, hey, there's going to be no heat this winter in the Capitol building. Everybody bring an extra coat. But these are not sustainable cuts with respect. But on the other hand, you're managing enough money that is outside of your control that's not labor-oriented. That the only way you would have to go on a rationing to pick up lower utilities. And so all you're doing, you're not reducing your budget. You're simply saying you've over-budgeted here. You can have some money back. And these budgets were built on high utility years, and so they stayed high. and then you have low utility years, and we, the reason we haven't reduced them is because we hope it gets cold again. Really cold. $8 an MCF cold.
Yeah. For how long? Even in the summer.
So it's a good point. I mean, it's a not a sustainable cut. It's, but on the other hand, when the governor looks at, hey, I've delivered an 8% cut overall, if all he's done is go into areas where there's over-budgeting, what we know is that if it gets cold, we have to backfill this, or we've got to reduce our temperature to 60 degrees in all of our buildings, which then has a problem with productivity. All right, next item.
Mr. Chairman, the next item can be found on page 54. 54 is in our real property leasing area. We're proposing a reduction of $700,000 in our leasing. Our total leasing fund is about $12 million per biennium. We believe that this reduction is possible due to the great job that our General Services Division has done by moving state agencies out of lease space into state-owned facilities. We've seen a number of agencies recently move into the Hathaway building. We've seen ETS consolidation, and we've seen moves to the military building, the Hanson building. We've seen lots of moves from leasing facilities to, once again, state-owned facilities. We believe that these reductions in leasing are something that, again, are something that we could support in our budget, and we recommend $700,000 in leasing reductions.
One of the things that I'd like to go over so that the new members understand, and that is with respect to leasing. So if we provide an agency 8 more positions, and there's a fiscal note for the cost of those positions, what the fiscal note does not cover is if they need 3 more offices, they go to A&I and said, we just picked up 4 more employees. A&I, if they have the space, they manage the space, but otherwise they just go out and lease. And the reason these leases grow is because we create positions without doing a fiscal analysis of space needs. And that's one thing we may want to do in the future is when you're analyzing new positions, one of the questions should always be, do you have the space capacity, or are they simply going to walk to A&I and said, good news, we got new employees, go find us some space, and then these budgets go up without, you're compelled just to go out and do the lease without an appropriation, but you have a fund that's available for that.
I just want to clarify a point. It's $12 million a year in lease space. I'm looking at the budget. It's $24 million. Is that correct? For biennium. Okay, thank you.
And once again, you have the same issue here that Don just referred to, and that is there's no way you could biennialize that number and still meet your lease payments, is there? And if that's for 1 year, are you going to be able to drop your whole budget by $1.4 million next biennium? You don't have that much. What you're doing is giving up the overage that you have. But you don't have another $700,000 overage, I assume.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
If you did, you'd net it to zero through the Chapter 17 process. So this is not going to yield 8% next year. So I think what we better do is, Brad, is we do need to see some categories on cuts that were simply a reduction in the overage that's built up in the appropriation, and cuts that can be biennialized. And when you start looking at that $60 million and say, okay, we're going to put that back into our general fund and we're going to spend some more, if the biennialized amount is $40 million or even $30 million and you're spending $20 million, you haven't saved much. And you know you have some of that because you have it in the woodwork effect for Department of Health. There alone, you're picking up another, it's $7 million. That's a $14 million biennial number. So we better take a look, what we're cutting and what we're growing. I don't think, we need to do that before the markup. We do an honest assessment. We look inside and say, honestly, what are we cutting? What are we growing out of the biennialized? And recognize a lot of these savings are simply built up overages that naturally accrue in accounts. It's okay to knock them down again, but they're also outside of our control in some areas. Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, before we leave the construction division, Dean, and more of an information thing for members of the committee, there's a bill that's being circulated out there to take some of the responsibilities from the Community College Commission and put them in the construction management division to do what I think would be a much better job of how we do our capital construction on our community colleges. And my question is more for information, and we can talk more about it as that bill progresses, but is there anything you'd like to comment on that now, or Rich, at this particular time? Or the bill's got a long ways to go, but I just wanted to afford you that opportunity while we're here in front of this committee.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I am aware of that bill. Mr. Cathcart has informed me of that. I don't have any specific comments unless Mr. Cathcart wishes to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, we are keenly aware of that bill. Frankly, and just from my own perspective, it's probably a pretty efficient way to centralize and control all construction in the state of Wyoming for state agencies and use similar construction documents and manage projects similarly at community colleges as we do with state projects. We are prepared to and looking at the reality of that bill becoming passing. Frankly, I thought there would be some turf war from the Community College Commission. I don't see that. Apparently, they really don't want to be in the construction business, and they seem to be fine with the idea or the concept that construction management would then work with the seven community colleges, and there's like 12 locations around the state where we have community college facilities to assist. Actually, that all came about when, you may recall, Governor Friedenthal had substituted general fund dollars to the community colleges with stimulus dollars, which come under the federal procurement. He also indicated at that point in time that our office would manage those projects. There was some resistance from the community colleges early on until they figured out we have the kind of expertise in our office that they don't have. Over time, they learned that we provide some valuable assistance to them. And currently, as far as I know, all of the college presidents are on board with that bill also. I believe it's probably a good step. Our office can do probably with two people what the colleges are currently doing with 14. Most of the colleges have two facilities staff folks on board that manage their projects at each community college. We believe we can provide the oversight and coordinate with their facilities folks to be a little more efficient and operate college projects similar to how we operate state projects. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a real good potential bill, and it sure deserves some consideration.
Let me.
The only thing I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, is there will be some position transfers. So you'll see the staff in Rich's division will go up by, I think it's one or one and two, by two positions. They'll come from Community College Commission to there if this bill proceeds.
Well,
thank you. That's all I have.
Here's one of the concerns, and Rich, while you're up, let's talk about this. You've been pretty unique because we hired you to start this, really, and at a time where we were, when we began this process, we had come off building a prison that was sinking with nobody to sue for. We were, every project was over about $4 or $5 million, and there were construction defects, and we couldn't get a hold of it. And you were pretty unique in that not only did you have your construction experience, but you, I think you sat over in Perkins' seat for about a few years, and I remember we had some nice battles back and forth. So you had, and you've always had direct access to the governor. And as you, as we start to look at succession planning for you, because apparently you're not unwilling to work anymore, the as we look for you're migrating out, what I'm wondering is, as we assign more responsibilities, we bring in more agencies, should we view it more like the IT division and have, or in order to have good quality management, we wanted to make sure that Flint Waters was directly responsible to the governor. And so we kind of created a hybrid out of his department. Right now, how do you view, I mean, are you reporting through Dean? You go to the governor? I assume you walk into the governor. I don't know. I mean, I see you in his office a lot. But how does that reporting work, and how do you think it should work after your departure?
Mr. Chairman, as you recall, and I know that you were on appropriations as well as Representative Harshman and myself, when we created the Office of Construction Management, and the vision we had and the legislative intent at the time was whoever filled that position worked directly for the governor, answered to the State Building Commission, and Joint Appropriations Committee or the legislature. So as we develop capital construction recommendations and projects, we bring our recommendations forward to the governor, State Building Commission, and the legislature. Our recommendations are what they are. There was no politics involved. So if there was a project that one of the State Building Commission members supported, but we didn't recommend it, that was our recommendation. When I first took this job, and in fact when I worked with you folks and I was a member of Appropriations to create the office, I had absolutely no idea that anyone would ever ask me to take this job. However, institutional memory, sometimes we do things in the legislature and we don't record the legislative intent. When I was hired, I was recruited and hired by Governor Friedenthal. I was approved by the State Building Commission, and I have always worked directly for the governor. I've had four or five ANI directors, but you may recall we even talked about creating an independent, separate agency for construction management. It wasn't feasible because the office was very small. So at the time, we discussed locating construction management within an existing agency. ANI was a perfect fit. So then they could take care of our budget issues and HR issues and all of those things. But we still operated independently from, let's say, the agency director. Over time then, 2 years into the job, Governor Friedenthal asked me to take over General Services. Reluctantly, and most of you know Governor Friedenthal, you can't really say no to him, but reluctantly, we ended up doing that. Then that put a portion of what I do in the direct accountability of Department of ANI. Construction management and general services are separate. They should be separate. However, they have to work closely with the trades and the buildings and grounds folks within ANI. We are accommodating that right now. I don't know, for example, as of today, how things are going to evolve when I leave. I'm not sure of that. One thing I can tell you for sure, as management of construction management, you need a real live construction person in that position who deals with construction issues, scheduling, change orders, those sorts of things, who is familiar with that and can make those kind of decisions. As of right now, I see my actual boss as the governor, state building commission, and the legislature. However, I work closely with director of A&I because I also am administrator for general services, which is part of A&I. So, frankly, when I leave, it doesn't matter to me if general services and construction management are together. But I think you need to maintain some independence for construction management from a bureaucracy. Oftentimes we create flowcharts and we put everybody in a box, and construction management doesn't really operate like that. You can't have people in boxes who do specific things and answer to a specific person. We coordinate so many things with so many agencies and legislators, and many of you on this committee know that I have worked independently from A&I with each of you on bill proposals, amendments, whatever, if it had to do with construction management. So,
it's time to deal that with your succession as we the planning. And I know, Dean, when you look at the flow chart that's in the front of your the budget, and it may have been by your predecessor that provides for it, it puts the construction manager essentially as a subordinate to the A&I director. And it is true that that was never our intent. Our intent was always that construction manager would go directly to the governor, and we and the appropriations would have direct access to them, because so much of our appropriation are for capital facilities, and they're, and like I say, it's the prison is a good example. You look at the old prison where we spent hundreds of millions of dollars on it only to find out that it was sinking, and we had to abandon parts of it, and we go to the new prison and we save money, and now we've got an empty wing to grow into because of good management. And those dollars are such had such a big swing. With the IT division, what we did is we created a budget, Section 300, to say, okay, here's what we want to do, and we did the legislation later. But I think as part of the budget, we need to come up with a recommendation, and I think that's really, Dean, is probably not your job. I do think that, Brett, we would like to have that discussion with the governor in terms of better defining that reporting role for the, you know, how we want to do it, whether we want to do a hybrid such as the IT. With Flint, while he's alone, you still provide a lot of the services for Flint's group, don't you?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Similar to what Flint is doing with consolidation, A&I is providing all of the accounting services to ETS, all of the billing services, as well as doing all of their HR function. So we are providing that agency with a lot of those resources as well. So it is a hybrid. As you know, ITD was once part of A&I, so it seemed like a good marriage. We're still in the same building for the most part.
How's it working?
Personally, I think it's working very well. Within A&I, we have a very good working relationship with ETS and their management. We have weekly meetings with our accounting folks, our director's office, and our HR folks, so that we're constantly communicating. As you can imagine, when an agency like that was created and consolidated, there were lots of HR issues, and there were lots of things that we have never seen before and had to address. We work collaboratively together, and I think we have a very strong working relationship.
Now, on a flow chart, Flint is he viewed as a director, or is he viewed as part of your department but reporting to the governor?
Mr. Chairman, the director of ETS reports directly to the governor. They're not part of A&I. A&I provides services to ETS primarily through an MOU, which is a memorandum of understanding. So we are separate in that sense.
Would there be any drawbacks or problems in and isolating construction management and giving them the same status?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question, and actually Mr. Cathcart and I have spent a lot of time talking about this in the last few months, looking at different ways perhaps the division could be organized. We recognize that construction management is a very unique entity to its own, and they need that direct access to the governor. One of the challenges that I've seen personally is I believe the statute says that the secretary of the State Building Commission is the General Services Division Administrator. So it is fairly specific in that sense about who is the secretary of the State Building Commission. We have been in consult with the AG's office to see if that can change or if we can redirect that purpose. But one of the things that Mr. Cathcart noted is that the construction management section does work very, very closely with general services, particularly with our facilities group and our skilled trades. So that relationship could continue, or it could be separated and it could be their own entities.
Well, I think what we want to do is, if we don't have the answer, we at least want to do a budget amendment to say, okay, this is for the next year, here are the rules of the road, and then we can develop the final analysis. If you know what you want with the governor, we can put a bill together. If you're not certain and you'd like to, we want to take baby steps that direction, we'll put a two-year or essentially one-year now budget amendment to make sure that we preserve the qualities that we look for, and at the same time you get the benefits out of that you need out of having a whole agency. So, Brad, if you talk to the governor and before markup, I'd like to have some recommendations from the executive branch on what you want. I think we have some strong opinions, or many of us have strong opinions, but we need to sort that out a little bit. Okay, with construction management, before we finish up, we'll go into executive session because we want to learn about property acquisitions, things like that. But we'll put you last on your budget, Rich. Dean, you just go continue to march through your budget with that in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're nearing the end of the 8% reductions, and then I will go into the supplemental request. The final 8% reduction comes out of the Human Resources Division, which is on page 57 of your budget in front of you. We are recommending that $252,000 be reduced from our budget. Those will primarily come through two areas in the Human Resources Division. One is a program that has been in place for a number of years for student interns. That fund, we believe that we could reduce by half, so we suggest that fund be reduced by $136,000. That's basically equivalent to approximately 20 summer interns during a calendar year. I would point out to you that this last year we have been scaling back the internship program, and we had 20 interns statewide, and the cost of that 20 interns was approximately $130,000. So it would still leave an intern program within the state. But it would also, if state agencies wanted to hire more interns, we would ask them to perhaps pay part of it or pay all of their intern funds for that program. We believe the internship is a very viable program. We don't want to see it go away. But if we're looking at reductions and we're actually cutting positions in state government, there is the opportunity here to reduce the number of part-time student intern program interns in this program.
Dean, do you know why the student intern program is declined? Is it because people aren't aggressively looking for interns, or interns don't like working for the government?
It declined this last year because of the number of interns that we made available to state agencies. with the dollars that we had available in our budget. The internship program was significantly impacted a number of years ago under Governor Friedenthal when A&I experienced our 10% reduction. So we've seen some gradual reductions in that program over the last couple of years. I would say the internship program has been a very viable program. We've seen students come and work for the state, and we've got testimony where they stayed as employees of the state or came back after they completed their schooling. So we do believe there is value in it. We could also explore other options, such as volunteer intern programs. I mean, there are a number of different ideas that we could look at here.
Questions? Next item.
Also, we are suggesting that we reduce the HR budget by $116,000, primarily for contractual services. In those contractual services, we do provide training to state employees and state agencies. We do, from time to time, bring in consultants to help us with various projects and programs. This would be the fund that we paid for the Hay study that you've heard a lot about. We still do consult with the Hay group as far as doing market surveys. And this is also the fund that we pay for a number of our online software programs. We believe that fund is adequately funded. We believe that we could reduce those funds without having a severe impact to the HR division.
Okay, next item.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I then would like to move into our supplemental requests, the first one beginning on page 69 of your budget in front of you. On page 69, we're requesting that $53,946 be appropriated as a supplemental ask. This is for our Economic Analysis Division. You may recall that in 2011, during the session, you required that the Economic Analysis Division provide services to counties throughout the state, providing economic modeling. That specific statute was 9-2-1024. What happened is that funding was appropriated for that model, but it was only funding for 1 year. We are now requesting a supplemental ask to pay for the second year of the biennium. We believe that since this was a request of the legislature, we would like to request this as part of our supplemental ask in front of you today.
I know you like it.
Mr. Chairman, and that's the economic analysis bill that came from the Ag Committee. I guess my question, and I support that. I mean, we had a lot of discussion. The legislature made a decision to do it. It wouldn't be fair if we didn't have the position to go along with what we've asked you to do. How is that going, and what's your perception of it?
I visited with Administrator Bill Mai, and he believes that software is being used effectively, and that the services that we're providing to the counties are appropriate. So, as you know, economic modeling is difficult, but it's a tool that the division needs to do their job appropriately. So, without continuing with that model, we would not be able to provide that service.
Okay, keep going.
Mr. Chairman, I actually skipped over the group insurance supplemental request. That's on page 65, so if I could have you return back to that page. What we are requesting is that the state of Wyoming has had a wellness program for the past 4 years in state government. The wellness program began fairly small and has continued. has continued to grow over the last couple of years, but quite honestly, it's not meeting quite the goal that we hoped it would. We are suggesting that the wellness program be revamped, if you will. The current wellness program provides a number of incentives for state employees to participate in wellness. We provide those incentives, which give state employees some kind of a monetary reward. The monetary reward is that if they complete a number of health challenges, they can see a reduction of their insurance claim or their insurance premium by $40 a month, as well as we incentivize them to do certain things such as go visit their doctor for a physical and to take a health assessment. We know that healthcare is a big issue not only for the state but for everyone right now, and we see that there are constant increases in the cost of health insurance. We believe that the state needs to be proactive in the way that we look at the management of our state employees and the employees that we cover in our insurance program. We need to find ways to focus, positive ways to promote people to get healthy and to remain healthy. We spend so much time in health insurance looking at paying claims for people that are sick, but I would propose that we also need to look at encouraging people to stay healthy. I would just like to point out to you that in 2011, the group insurance program did health fair assessments of participants in our program through the Wyoming Health Fairs. We're beginning to collect some metrics and data on employees in an aggregate format. What I found interesting, and I just wanted to briefly share this with the committee, that as a result of those employees coming to the Wyoming Health Fair, we found that 52% of all employees participating in the health assessment had pre-hypertension or were hypertensive. So there's an example of where half of our state employees are approaching that area. 61% of all of our state employees were overweight or obese, according to tables and guidelines. 50% are not getting the number of recommended hours of exercises required. And a lot of employees are facing stress, and 77%, according to the study, are not eating the recommended fruits and vegetables. 10% of our state employees admitted that they're using tobacco. 66% of the employees admitted that they were involved in high-risk activities, such as not using seat belts. The list goes on and on. 20% have high cholesterol, 22% high triglycerides. The point I'm trying to make on this is that there is room for improvement, and we believe that we need to encourage state employees to manage their health better, and we need to incentivize it. This current year, we are again changing our wellness program, and it is moving away from providing employees with health challenges. We are our wellness program this year is primarily focused on providing information to employees. What we would like to do is move our wellness program to something that again incentivizes employees more, and we would like to move more towards wellness programs that involve health coaching. And what we mean by that is that employees that are participants that are identified as employees that could use improvement in their health, they could be assigned a health coach that could come and work alongside those participants to provide them with the information or to give them the encouragement to change their lifestyles. This is a fairly robust program. We're very excited about suggesting it to you. We want to work very closely in cooperation with the Wyoming Health Fair and the Mayo Health Clinic in running these health assessments. So we believe that it's a very valid program and one that's necessary as far as encouraging participants to manage their health styles and health issues much better. one of the questions that has always come before this committee is evaluating the effectiveness of a wellness program. And we think that by taking steps and moving in this direction, working with the Wyoming Health Fair, for example, we will be, as employees come and participate in those health fairs, we will be physically taking their blood pressure, we'll be weighing them, we'll be generating some of those metrics that we can use. We would suggest to you that as we make changes in moving and changing our wellness program, that we look at using health coaching, if you will, in a pilot study for the next 3 years, and at the conclusion of that, we hire an independent consultant to come in and review that to see the effectiveness of the wellness program. So there would be some accountability with this program, and we believe that hopefully we would have better metrics to provide to this committee at the conclusion whether the wellness program is truly effective, needs modified, or changed.
Yeah, that all sounds great. To work on our costs. What? Why the Mayo Clinic? Is that? Are they providing some service that you can't get out of a Wyoming institution?
There, maybe I can have Ralph come up and help with that. But primarily, the Mayo Clinic helps with the health risk assessment of our participants. Okay. Mr. Chairman, when we look at rates overall, as I usually come before the committee, I expect additional medical claims every single year because what the physicians are charging, what the hospitals are charging, what prescription drug companies are charging continue to go up. So even if we stay at the same utilization levels, our costs go up. On the other hand, this upcoming year, I'm actually having a rate decrease for the program. Our reserves have crept up over the past year. I had anticipated 11.6% increase in medical claims. That has come in right around 6.9% instead. We've also seen an increase in the number of family contracts versus single contracts, which has also added additional income we weren't anticipating. Therefore, to reduce our reserve levels, we're actually having a rate decrease for calendar year 2013. However, on the other hand, I'm also anticipating $218 million in medical claims that we will actually pay in 2013. While I'm on the subject, if I may, just for some background information on the Employees Group Insurance Program, since I see some new members, this program provides self-funded health insurance and dental insurance plus some other side benefits for the executive branch, the University of Wyoming, the seven community colleges, and also any K-12 school district who wishes to participate in the plan. And at this point in time, only Natrona County School District has elected to participate in the plan. Mr. Chairman, what I'm seeing right now is we're seeing a slowing of, shall we say, healthcare inflation. So where what I've been seeing in the past few years has been more in the 11 to 16%. What I'm seeing is a slowing of that now where last year we were roughly at 6.9%, which is the projection we're using for this upcoming year, and doing a rate decrease to, again, reduce those reserves. I can't point to any one thing. I would like to hope that our wellness program has something to do with that. But bottom line, I can't point to my finger at any one thing that's slowing our utilization. Mr. Chairman, I anticipate requesting another significant increase in spending authority. We are other funded, so we operate on the premiums we collect from the participants and the agencies who are providing an employer contribution for this program.
Explain what you mean when you say you're underfunded and at the same time you've got rate holidays. What does that mean? How do you put those together?
Mr. Chairman, when we had a recent rate holiday 2 years ago, we were seeing rate trends in excess of roughly 16%. So when you are projecting forward for your rates, you use what's happened in the most recent history, expecting that to continue. We utilized that projection on what the trends look like, and we found our trends weren't quite that high. So our rates were set with that. We needed the rate holiday because we exceeded. Unlike risk management, we don't keep 3 years worth of reserves. We keep 3 months worth of reserves. So I exceeded that point in time. We actually have an arrangement with the federal government to where we can keep up to 3 months worth of reserves. We needed to reduce that. Otherwise, they were going to take probably a disproportionate share of those reserves back. But by doing a rate holiday, we're able to, on a proportionate basis, put it back into the agency's 100 series. So the federal programs that are funded get only their fair share and not any additional amount. But also the employees who contribute their portion get their share back also.
And for the vice versa, we're the largest contributor, so we get our money. So the rate holiday applies to our own budgets.
Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely correct. When we do a rate holiday, what we do is leave the money into those 100 series, so any general fund amounts for those generally funded agencies reverts at the end of the biennium.
Did I catch you right? Did you say that you anticipate a significant increase next year because we're underfunded?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying that we're underfunded. We're funded fine. I have sufficient reserves, but I do anticipate medical claims continuing to grow. Therefore, in anticipation of that, the current spending authority I have for those medical claims we're expected to pay is not going to be sufficient for the upcoming biennium. So I will be doing that calculation based upon most recent information in April to provide to budget, and at that point in time we will have numbers on what the spending authority estimates will be.
Ralph, when you meet with your folks and your underwriters, or I guess it would be your actuaries, do you talk to them about the impacts of the Medicaid expansion on your rates or up and down, or is that something that comes into your
Mr. Chairman, really, the Medicaid expansion discussions don't really have a direct impact upon our program. We are basically like any other insurer. We're subject to Wyoming state statutes. We're required to act like another insurer. On the group insurance market, that expansion really doesn't affect large employer plans.
The question is there a discussion with respect to whether or not embedded in your rates is a cost shifting from medical providers, such that if that group is, their costs are picked up, whether your rates or your costs go down, or is that, I'm just curious whether there's, you've heard discussions like that, or whether that's outside of anything you've heard.
Mr. Chairman, there is that potential, but we'll actually do it based upon what the actual utilization of our program is. So if we see an elimination of cost shifting where we're not being cost shifted against so much, we will be adjusting our rates accordingly as we move forward. So we're going to do it based upon what actually happens to the program, not trying to project what's going to happen in the future, because nobody really knows what will happen with that, in especially in this particular state. The reason I say that is, let's face it, we're a very large geographical state, and we don't really have competition for our medical providers. It's not like we have multiple hospitals or generally multiple specialties in any particular area, except maybe in Casper for some of the back surgeons. But for the most part, I would call it frontier medicine, and the cost of care in Wyoming is probably the highest in the country because of that fact.
I think Representative Edmonds has some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wanted to ask questions about the wellness program. It's my last opportunity. We've had the program in the state for 4 years. What has the cost been to the state these past 4 years? Do you know? Can you give me a rough estimate?
Mr. Chairman, the approximate cost to the program would have been roughly $800,000 a year, depending on the membership. It's crept up to about that point.
And I know that Director Fawcett made the comment that you haven't seen the kind of realized results that you were hoping to. Can you give me a little more detailed description of what results you have seen, what you were hoping to achieve, and particularly how you track results?
Mr. Chairman, the problem with what we currently have is we don't have a good methodology for tracking results. We are seeing a reduced trend in our medical claims, but I can't attribute that to any one factor. What my proposal is for this test pilot is that we hire an actuary to take a baseline picture of what we currently have at the end of the 3 years and have them look at the medical utilization and have this actuary give us a definitive answer. Is the wellness program working or not working?
Mr. Chairman, how exactly will an actuarial study be able to track when a wellness program is not a coded program where you can actually follow what is happening in the medical life of your employees? So how is an actuarial going to be able to actually, you can make assumptions, but there's no way that they can actually say that a wellness coach achieved real results.
Mr. Chairman, that's my best avenue for measuring this program. I can't attest to the details. I'm not an actuary.
Okay, I'll move on. On the health coach issue, how many I know this is going to be a pilot program, right? How many health coaches to begin with?
Mr. Chairman, there won't be actually a hired health coach. This is why Wyoming Health Fairs, in conjunction with, we're going to be working with the Mayo Clinic. This will be actually accomplished on a contract basis. So we're not talking about hiring coaches to handle this within the state budget. It will be based upon utilization that is going to, again, the Mayo Clinic and some of it to the Wyoming Health Fairs.
Okay, so when you mention health coaches in the pilot program, we're not actually going to have a health. How are we going to be able to understand if the pilot program is successful if you want to ultimately begin a whole program with health coaches if we're not going to have health coaches on the ground in the state?
Basically, a lot of it will be monitored. I would anticipate much of it will be done telephonically. Patients, in order to qualify that they're working through the program, will have to meet certain criteria. They will have to do certain things. And ultimately, we look to, are they controlling their H1C1s if they're diabetic? Are they starting to be consistent with their medication regimen and not being noncompliant? Those type of issues.
And what do you ultimately envision after the three-year pilot program for the state? I mean, can you give us an estimate of how many health coaches would need to be employed to actually bring this program into full usage?
We're anticipating roughly 8 to 12,000 participants. We're actually focusing on the employees and retirees, not the dependents on the program, since those we can actually also hopefully measure sick and annual leave. Well, excuse me, not annual leave, but sick leave also, because we would anticipate if people are taking better care of themselves and they're controlling especially chronic care conditions, we'll see a reduction in sick leave. But we're targeting that we would hope to get about 8,000 on a minimum basis.
8,000 health coaches?
No, excuse me, 8,000 members who participate.
So do you have a rough estimate of how many health coaches you'd have on the ground?
No, I do not.
Okay. Absent a long diatribe, I don't have any other questions, Mr. Chairman.
So I don't know why you insult poor Ray that way, but anyway. just to follow up on Representative Edmonds' question, I mean, ultimately, when Mayo showed up and offered you the program, I mean, ultimately they gave you some indication that there are some metrics or something out there that is measurable. Otherwise, no one would buy their product. So I mean, so when you start down this, what metrics? What measurements are out there to find out if this program's been a success? I mean, not, otherwise you're just buying a pig and a poke. I don't know how that works. Now, and I'll tell you that that Director Forslund, when he was city manager in Casper, instituted one of these programs and thought it was a great thing and it made a tremendous difference. But you know, obviously that's a much smaller population overall. So, I'd be interested in your response,
Mr. Chairman. What I find from wellness vendors is the fact that they do not generally come with hard measurements. That's why I would utilize an actuary to see what behavior change we can, and if we can see some kind of better adhesion to take people taking care of themselves and eating better and ultimately slowing down our medical trends. I'm finding wellness vendors, while they have a formula, it's not necessarily one I believe in. So that's why I would rather rely upon an actuary to deal with hard numbers, but I don't get hard numbers from any wellness vendors.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I take it with the actuary / consultant that you're going to bring in to do that, that the program would set up metrics or set up some kind of measurement, some kind of markers out there, so that you could actually analyze and determine whether this is making, whether you're getting the bang for the buck that you would anticipate.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other follow-up. I did notice in the narrative, and I forgot to ask you this question, because you were discussing not just the wellness program, but also a part of a movement toward value-based health care. And in the description discussing, you know, seeking the highest value relative to the quality-cost ratio and effectiveness, I know I've done quite a bit of research into value-based healthcare, and it's oftentimes code for the idea of not necessarily rationing, but certainly when you're talking value versus quality cost, it certainly is going to be a much more of a barrier between the employee and their ability to get the kind of healthcare that they may believe they want, they may value over what their employer values. So give me an idea of your vision of what you think value-based healthcare is going to be for the state.
Mr. Chairman, the value-based healthcare really ties very closely with what's going on to the $250,000 appropriation to start educating or bringing the medical practices across Wyoming on the primary care side into some kind of a medical home model to where they're taking a much more active role in providing services to their patients. And this really becomes key when you're dealing with certain chronic care conditions. Diabetes is one of the key ones. A lot of our primary care providers are more on a traditional side. And I attended a meeting just recently with the Integrated Care Network and their efforts on that. And the consultant they have hired to do this training has done their initial assessments on the practices who are elected to participate in this project. And what they found, they kind of figured they would hopefully find a mix of providers that were already headed down this value-based where they're really trying to take an active role and get diabetics in to make sure they're getting the testing done they need, doing their eye exams and things like that. But what they found was very traditional medical care and even maybe a little bit less than that, meaning the doctors aren't taking a role, seeing what's in their own medical records, making sure these chronic care conditions are coming in, they're monitoring these conditions, taking better care of themselves. So ultimately, a lot of this value-based health care is really tied into that initiative to where once we get medical providers moving to provide more integrated care for a patient-centric side where they're looking at the whole patient and maybe helping them care not only for their chronic care needs, but if they need some additional services, help them navigate the medical specialty side and help them get that care. But trying to incentivize these medical providers to do that and support those services, that's what I see as far as value-based medicine, is taking proven medical practices on the treatment of these conditions and apply it on a consistent basis for all Wyoming members, not just state employees and their dependents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand it, but I want to be sure. In the governor's message, you talked about $16.9 million that was out there and how that relates to what you're talking about in your situation. That's my first question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm unsure of the message that we're referring to.
Apparently, there is an underutilization of the health care benefits. So there's in your health care benefits account, they've accrued about $16.9 million that you don't think you're going to need in premiums. I assume it's from the rate holidays, things like that.
Mr. Chairman, bottom line is, yes, our reserve levels are creeping up to above where I would like them to be, and the rate decrease is really leaving money that we would have otherwise thought would go into our program. It's leaving in the agency's 100 series for the state university and community colleges. So in essence, rather than doing a one-month rate holiday, we're handling it through a lower rate for the upcoming year. So while I can't speak to the $16 million because that's a budget figure, that's not really tied to the insurance, what I'm doing is reducing the rates, which does, in fact, leave some money in those 100 series.
And Mr. Chair, my follow-up to that is understanding it in that situation now, what do you anticipate like for the next budget cycle? Is this kind of a one-time deal, or do you see these kind of things continue, or do you see them going the other way? Sounds like you see them going the other way.
Mr. Chairman, I always expect higher medical costs, always anticipate medical costs. I do not see them going down, and in fact, in some areas, for instance, prescription drugs, I see them getting worse. I mean, when you look at the price we're paying for outpatient prescription drugs, let me give you an example. I came to this agency actually from the insurance side 11 years ago. At that point in time, we were spending 12 cents out of every dollar on outpatient prescription drugs.
Today we're paying 25 cents out of every dollar on outpatient prescription drugs. Now we're trying to mitigate that somewhat. We went out for an RFP last year. We've hired a more aggressive pharmacy benefit manager. We're now requiring step therapy for some high-cost medications, and we're able to impact, but that impact is going to be on a one-time basis. It will continue, but I still see higher use of specialty medications. In fact, when you look at what they call the pipeline for drugs that are under development and expected to come out, they're not going after the $100 medications, $200 medications. They're going after the $3,000 medications, the $5,000 medications for a 30-day supply. So in this one particular area, I see prescription drugs costs going up and seeing some scary estimates into the future. We might end up spending as much as 40% of every dollar on outpatient prescription drugs within 10 years. And that's a frightening perspective. And some of these manufacturers are even offering coupon discounts to where it's actually cheaper for somebody to take the $3,000 medication than take a much lower cost alternative and pay a $10 copay. And that's difficult for me to swallow. Mr. Chairman, when I came on 11 years ago, it was 12 cents out of every dollar, and today, well, last year, I should say, for 2012, it was 25 cents out of every dollar. Now, we have impacted that. I did a rough estimate yesterday, and we've brought that down to roughly 17 cents out of every dollar, but it's still a significant part of our health care span and, quite frankly, the fastest growing within our program.
Mr. Chairman, the whole point of that was to this money that we see is it could very well be it goes totally the other way in the next biennium, and that's what I wanted to be sure.
Mr. Chairman.
The other question I have, Mr. Brett, did you have something?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, I just wanted to note for you that there is a reduction in premium that's already gone into effect for the coming calendar year. It went into effect, I believe, this month. And so the calculation that we've done is a projection of the excess spending authority that rests not only with executive branch agencies, but also with judicial, also with the university and community colleges. And we've identified the general, the federal, and the other fund portion. The $16.9 million represents only the general fund portion. So that's excess spending authority that is out there that, in the context of the governor's recommendation and what's going on in the state auditor's budget where he's parking that spending authority, he is just essentially saying, let's capture this at this point in time and hold it because of the uncertainty that we see with respect to these costs.
I understand that. And Mr. Chairman, about the group itself, and Natrona is the only the school district that's come on board, has there been any thought about expanding that, allowing other government, quote, subdivisions, districts, whatever, not subdivision, but agencies of government to come on board? Has that been discussed? Is that a real, really a good idea, or is that a bad idea?
Mr. Chairman, there are a lot of outside entities who would like to participate. However, what we've tried to limit this is really an employer-based program. We're not trying to be the insurer. We're not trying to compete with the Blue Cross, Blue Shields, the Aetnas out there. The K through 12 makes absolutely sense because they're directly funded by the legislature, as is the university, the community colleges, and the executive branch. So the K through 12 districts make sense. Once you get beyond that, I don't know if it really makes sense to allow cities, counties to participate into the program.
Mr. Chairman, but why? Because the more people in, the better it is. The more you can spread the risk around and deal with high, you know, a high individual risk and these kind of claims, I would think it would make more sense to, if they really are government agencies or quasi-government agencies, why wouldn't you want them?
Mr. Chairman, with the appropriate rules to that they would have to meet the same eligibility guidelines, the same minimum employer contributions, it can be managed, but bigger is not always better. Now, we are very efficient. We spend less than 4 cents out of every dollar to administer this program. So that leaves roughly a little over 96 cents out of every dollar to be out there to pay for medical claims. So while we're efficient, in the past, I know there was when we were looking at the K through 12 situation, and there was quite a bit of pushback from the insurance agents and market and insurers on that particular initiative.
Ralph, when we authorized the districts to come in, there were a bunch of districts that were complaining that their costs were going up. They couldn't control it. Natrona came in, and it's what appears to have happened is now that they have the option to go to you, that something must have happened where those providers got more competitive or something happened. Do you have a sense of what? I know that you've talked to other districts. Did they get lower rates once you came onto the picture? What happened?
Mr. Chairman, really the Natrona County School District had the same basic demographics as the state did, same average age, same dependent mixture. So their utilization and it being as large as ours was pretty much identical to ours. What it did allow is now we had an additional 2,200 employees plus their dependents on the program. We got better negotiating ability in the Casper region, and we started getting some of the docs up there to become participating with Cigna. So it gave us some leverage to get better deals in the Casper area. And they were consistently a holdout area as far as participating with our program and providing discounts. They felt they were going to get it anyway, but with the addition of Natrona, we actually started getting through to that.
And so those are the benefits, but we had small communities, lost areas that said they couldn't get insurance, and all of a sudden those other group plans, those Blue Cross plans, must have really stepped up, and because they seem to be taken care of and their rates seem to have stabilized. Do you know whether they have stabilized, or are you anticipating a flood of districts to come onto the plan?
Mr. Chairman, when I've talked on an annual basis, I talk to several school districts on a year, and they look at our program as possibly an option. Usually, in some cases, they don't want to lose the flexibility they currently have. They've built a agent-broker relationship. Maybe their employer contribution isn't as high as ours is, and they don't want to meet the same eligibility rules. And ultimately, the rest of the districts have so far chosen not to do that. But I do know Natrona coming on board, they saw a net savings coming onto the program.
Mr. Chairman, that completes our 8% reduction proposal before you and our two supplemental requests.
All right. So,
certainly.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to ongoing projects, Construction Management Office currently has, and bear in mind this includes a number of community college projects and some follow-up on major maintenance, but it also includes all of the major maintenance projects that we're working on. We currently have somewhere in the vicinity of 100 projects under contract, somewhere between being approved for funding and final completion. The major projects we're working on at this point are still, believe it or not, Torrington Prison. We're on some punch list issues and warranty issues there. That project isn't totally closed out. However, we've occupied it for a couple of years now, and it's functioning and doing well. But we're not totally closed out on that project. The joint lab facility is completed and closed out. We are still, however, involved in some issues with regard to landscaping and those things that will be completed next spring. We are managing the design and construction of the new STEM building at the University of Wyoming. We're about ready to go into DD, that's design documents for that project. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we've worked with the University of Wyoming and some of the community, which includes a couple of Albany County senators, in looking at the aesthetics and the fit and the appearance of that facility. We should be ready to go to bid on that project, hopefully for a spring start. We're working on the final design as we speak. We have lots of other smaller projects. We're about to finish the retirement home, which or the Pioneer Home, which was had a total $6 million renovation. It's taken time because we have to work with folks and that live there and work on wings at a time. But that's been a nice project. If any of you have an opportunity to go up and look at it, please stop by. They're very proud of it, and it was a nice job. The other major construction projects, Jim, we're pretty cleaned up at State Fair. They're getting ready for a big celebration. We're doing some projects up there. They did have their 100th last year, and there was quite a lot added there that we didn't get finished, but we're about to finish that. Lots of small projects going. Mr. Chairman, with that said, in the property acquisition area, and we have some specific items we would like to bring to your attention, which will require executive session. But over time, we have acquired a lot of property. Earlier on, you were talking about reducing the leasing budget. That's a direct result, and it's going to keep getting better, of the state's ability to acquire some property and actually build and do capital investment. One of which, just one example, is we've just recently let the contract for the final renovation of the fifth floor of the Hathaway building. That's been a kind of a contentious process because we moved the public health labs off of the fifth floor, and because of contamination and CDC requirements and all of that, it's taken an unbearable length of time to get into the actual renovation of that. But that space will be occupied by two significant state agencies who are both currently in pretty high-dollar lease space. We plan on moving the Community College Commission into there, which is general-funded, and the School Facilities Commission, which is general-funded. Both of those agencies are currently in pretty high-cost lease space. So as things progress, we've managed and been able to acquire, we think, pretty important properties with, and as you know, that's a function of the State Building Commission and with support from the legislature, of course, for funding. But there's been a substantial amount of capital investment, and so your leasing costs are going down, and we think it'll keep getting better. One of the things that kind of offsets that is as our lease contracts renew, over time, naturally, the lease rates go up. It's just a part of inflation. So, Mr. Chairman, as you know, and as a member of the State Building Commission, they approved the purchase of the building at 325 West 25th Street, which was the old Delta Dental building, directly across the street from the parking garage and directly across the street from the Safeway property and catty corner from the Pioneer building. With good acquisition, 16,000 square foot of space, we bought that property and negotiated a contract which was not quite $100,000 under appraised value. We're currently in the process of doing the renovation design work. We have negotiated with all the tenants that are in the building, and the tenants should all be out of the building by the first of the year. Hopefully we're going to have a spring start to renovate that, and we'll have a substantial office building there to move folks into.
with respect to the A&I folks who are here, figure out who should be here, and then we'll ask everybody to excuse themselves. And then, Don, would you, on the way out, would you go get Senator Ross in the other building? Or in the, he's doing the training and bring him down?